In the world of college football, the name Bill Hancock invariably gets a smile, which is ironic because if you say the name of Bill Hancock's employer, often you'll get a sneer. Hancock is the executive director of the Bowl Championship Series, or as it's known to its many critics, the event that's killing college football. The BCS uses computers and polls to match the two top-ranked teams in a title game. Those critics would rather have a more inclusive playoff. Tomorrow night in Glendale, Arizona, this year's two top teams, Auburn and Oregon, play for the BCS championship. As NPR's Tom Goldman reports, Bill Hancock is happily doing his job amidst the grumbling.
They come in waves. Reporters at a college football media event this past week find the tall man with the wire-rimmed glasses and easy manner.
See you, Christine.
Bye-bye. Take care.
Hey, Rachel.
Hey, morning. How are you?
Yahoo Sports national columnist Dan Wetzel wasn't part of the hotel ballroom scene in Scottsdale, but he knows the meet and greet was genuine.
When Bill Hancock asks you how you're doing, he actually wants to know the answer. I don't think you find that often in American society anymore.
High praise, especially from a guy who co-wrote a book titled Death to the BCS. It came out a couple of months ago and already is in its fourth printing. Wetzel's book says the current system of running college football's postseason with no playoffs hurts the universities financially and, says Wetzel, doesn't serve the competitive interests of players and fans. There is the well-researched BCS bashing by journalists like Wetzel. Then there are firebombs.
The people that run the BCS are the most short-sighted mental midgets anywhere in sports administration, anywhere in the world.
Thrown by public figures like James Carville, which leaves Bill Hancock a bit confused.
I don't understand some of the anger about it. The invective is a little hard to deal with, but it doesn't get me down.
If anything, it motivates Hancock to get to work. Affably, of course.
Hi, this is Bill Hancock with the BCS. I'm good, except I'm late.
BCS Championship Week, which means even more interviews than Hancock normally gives. In 2009, his bosses wanted Hancock to be more aggressive in, as he puts it, telling the story of why the BCS is important. This phone interview Friday was with a radio host named Chris in Atlanta.
We get it that some people would like to do something different, but what we have now gives us a compelling regular season and a bowl system that benefits way more teams than a playoff ever would.
The BCS hired Hancock in 2005, partly because he had the right temperament for what one BCS official calls a thankless job. Hancock has a natural sense of humor. When he was in his 20s, he and his brother owned the local newspaper in his hometown of Hobart, Oklahoma. He had the freedom to do anything with the paper, and he did, one beautiful spring day.
The front page was blank except for one line. It said, "Today's front page canceled on account of spring fever." And then on page two, I put a banner headline that said, "Okay, if you got to have news, here it is." And we put some news in.
And the barbs from BCS bashers aren't quite as sharp to a man who's known the pain of losing a child. 31-year-old Will Hancock died in a plane crash in 2001. Bill wrote a book about coping with the death. It endeared him even more to the college football press corps, the same press corps that will keep hammering away at the BCS while Hancock keeps smiling. He hopes.
I've told a couple of dear friends that if you see me changing because of all this, let me know, because I don't want to become someone different.
So far, so good. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Weekend Edition Saturday host Scott Simon and his family are friends with Congresswoman Giffords. He offers these personal thoughts this morning.
Gabby Giffords has true grit. I don't mean the kind you see in movies, but the grit to work hard, love your family, and serve your country. She's smart, sharp, funny, and as so many of her colleagues have noted over this past day, brave. The next time you're tempted to mock members of Congress, you might think about Gabby, who flies back and forth across the country every week, losing sleep, missing her family, and wearing herself down, but determined to cast tough votes and fly back home to answer for them. Our families are friends. We don't talk a lot about politics when we get together, as much as kids and parents, great quesadillas, and all the new movies we never get a chance to see. We swap jokes and dreams. Gabrielle Giffords went to Scripps College and Cornell, was a Fulbright scholar in Mexico, worked in New York finance, and came back to Tucson to run her family's tire business before entering politics. Her husband, Mark Kelly, is an astronaut and the family member that people usually worry about. But last spring, after Gabby voted for health care overhaul, somebody shot a pellet gun into the glass of her Tucson office. I don't think I violate any confidences to say Gabby has worried that intemperate people, I'll call them nuts and cranks, are poisoning politics in the state she loves. She seems to cherish the sometimes curmudgeonly independence of her district. I've heard her complain about the constant strain of raising money and getting middle seats on long airplane flights, but never about meeting with her constituents, even if it's just to hear harangues. The people who were shot alongside her yesterday, including those who died, were her friends and neighbors. I know her family wants the media to pay attention to them, too. Gabrielle Giffords has always had close, fierce election battles in which she's been counted out but comes back to win. She's fighting for her life now, but she knows how to do that. A lot of people have learned, never count out Gabby Giffords.
And that was my colleague, Weekend Edition Saturday host, Scott Simon. You're listening to NPR News.
This past week, the British Medical Journal released a report calling a 1998 study linking vaccines to autism a, quote, absolute fraud. The man who led that study, Andrew Wakefield, was already stripped of his medical license in Britain last year, and the journal that published his work, Lancet, retracted it as well. Wakefield offered his reaction on CNN earlier in the week.
What this is a ruthless, pragmatic attempt to crush any investigation into valid vaccine safety concerns.
Wakefield's study unleashed a powerful anti-vaccine movement in Europe and in the United States. Many parents, worried about reports of a link between vaccines and developmental disorders, chose and continue to choose not to have their kids immunized. One of those parents was Kelly Lasick, and one night in April 2006, Kelly and her husband were on their way out to a church dance near their home outside Pittsburgh. Before they left, their youngest son, 3-year-old Matthew, complained of a sore throat. At first, the Lasicks didn't think much of it.
So we just made sure he was okay. We went to the dance, and then when we got back, he was laboring to breathe. He was, hunched over and just laboring to breathe. We figured, oh, we'll just take him to the local hospital, which is Forbes Regional.
As his fever reached 104, doctors gave Matthew Tylenol and tried to help ease his congestion. They thought it might be asthma, but the treatments weren't helping.
It was actually more of a seasoned or veteran doctor that came in, too. And the gentleman had asked me, after he looked at him and said, did you have your son vaccinated? And at that point, you know, I said no. And then he knew exactly at that point exactly what it was. And he said, if this is what I think it is, he doesn't have that much time to live.
The doctor determined Matthew had HIB, a potentially deadly bacterial disease that leads to meningitis. Before the vaccine came onto the market in 1985, 1,000 children under age 3 died from it each year. Since then, it's been virtually eradicated, but in recent years, it's returned to children who have not received the HIB vaccine. In Matthew's case, the clock was ticking. No one was sure whether he'd live.
By Tuesday, he was starting. His blood pressure and his heart rate were fluctuating, and it was just really hard. We weren't sure if we were going to lose him or not. This is the first time I actually cried. Sorry. So at that point, you know, the doctors, the young doctors were there, and we would just whisper in his ear, and you can just see the tears coming down his face because he wasn't able to communicate with us.
Matthew spent 6 days in the hospital. Finally, on a Tuesday afternoon, after high doses of antibiotics, he came out of a medically induced coma, and his breathing tube was removed.
They took the tube out, and as soon as he came out, you know, he was just learning to go to the bathroom at that point, and he said, I have to go potty. And then his favorite movie was on TV, and he just wanted to watch the movie.
Amazingly, Matthew recovered. Today, he's 7. He has no lasting brain damage or developmental effects. And at the time, this is what the lead doctor said to Kelly Lasick.
Please do me a favor. When you know, you make a decision with your husband to get him vaccinated right away. But he said he's a one-in-a-million child that came out of this with, you know, nothing wrong with him.
Kelly Lasick's story is told in a new book by journalist Seth Mnookin. It's called The Panic Virus. Over the past 2 years, a record number of children have been diagnosed with pertussis, or whooping cough, a disease that was virtually eradicated with a vaccine. Same with measles. And Mnookin wanted to get to the bottom of the phenomenon, why so many educated parents choose to either not vaccinate their children or to wait on them.
When I started working on the book, I really had no sense one way or another what the reality of the situation was. And I started to hear a lot about it both in the media and from my friends, from my peers who were young parents or having children and were also very concerned with this. So as I looked into it and researched it, I found interesting the way people justified themselves relying on instinct and intuition as opposed to research and facts.
So to you, there is no debate that to have someone on who would make a counterargument that would say, yes, vaccines are dangerous, that's an illegitimate argument in your view because the science doesn't back it up. There is no debate.
Yes, I think at this point, this is probably the issue regarding public health that has received more attention from scientists and researchers around the world than any other single issue. We're sort of at an asked and answered juncture of this.
In 2010, the journal Pediatrics released a poll that showed that 25%, this is last year, 25% of parents believe vaccines can cause developmental disorders in healthy kids. I know that you're a parent. I'm a parent. I've got a kid who has been vaccinated. But, you know, I have to admit every time I took him to the doctor, in the back of my mind there was that thought. Did you ever have that?
Absolutely. And I think that that is very understandable. And in fact, I think one of the reasons we've gotten to this point is because for too long, the medical community and the public health community treated parents who came in and had concerns as if they were crazy, as if they almost had no right to bring this up.
You have a chapter in the book about Jenny McCarthy, the actress. It's called Jenny McCarthy's Mommy Instinct. And she, of course, is an outspoken vaccination critic. And I want to play a clip for her. This is her appearance on Larry King in 2008.
Well, the schedule back in 1983 was 10 shots given. Today, there are 36 shots given.
You think that's too many?
Too many too soon. We need to get rid of the toxins, the mercury, which I'm so tired of everyone saying that's been removed, aluminum, ether, antifreeze. These are toxic ingredients in shots.
Seth Mnookin, this is scary stuff to hear for any parent. How significant and important has Jenny McCarthy been for the anti-vaccination movement?
She has probably brought more attention to this over the last half decade than any other single person. In that instance, on Larry King, well, there isn't antifreeze in vaccines. Mercury has been removed from childhood vaccines. There is a mercury preservative that is in some variants of the flu vaccine. This is one of those areas people get bogged down in it, but the type of mercury was ethyl mercury as opposed to methyl mercury, which is the mercury that we know can be very poisonous.
And by the way, there has been no link found between the mercury and any developmental disorders.
I mean, not only that, there have been studies involving literally millions of children showing that there is no link. Even if you put on Jenny McCarthy with someone from the CDC or a pediatrician, it gives the impression that there's sort of an equal number of people on two sides of this. And for years, this was framed through a narrative of parents who believed that their children had been injured by vaccines. And that's a very compelling narrative and a very difficult one to counteract with research papers and scientists who sound as if they're speaking to graduate seminars.
Given that 25% of parents are worried about whether vaccines can cause disorders, presumably this is going to become a worse problem.
Well, I think there are a couple of reasons to be hopeful. The public health community and doctors are aware of the need to communicate more effectively in a way that they weren't a decade ago. So in pediatricians' offices, there are now oftentimes informational pamphlets, vaccine seminars that are held after office hours. I think what is dangerous is opening up Google and typing in vaccines autism. And so we need to make intelligent decisions about where we're going to get our information.
That's Seth Mnookin. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His new book is called The Panic Virus, The True Story of Medicine, Science, and Fear. Seth Mnookin, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Many states across the country have some big budget holes to fill this year, and public employees are worried about what that means for them. In New York, newly elected Governor Andrew Cuomo wants to slash state agencies and freeze public workers' pay for a year. And in California, which is struggling to close a $28 billion deficit, Jerry Brown is sending mixed signals to the labor allies who helped him get elected governor. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Jerry Brown's return to the governor's office after nearly 30 years was a stripped-down, no-frills affair, and he wasted no words warning that California's budget promises pain and sacrifice.
Choices have to be made and difficult decisions taken. At this stage of my life, I've not come here to embrace delay and denial.
Brown said closing the budget gap means putting everything on the table: schools, prisons, the environment.
We'll also have to look at our system of pensions and how to ensure that they're transparent and actuarially sound and fair, fair to the workers and fair to the taxpayers.
That line drew no applause from the labor-friendly audience. 2 hours later, Brown dropped by a union-sponsored inauguration party featuring free hot dogs and mariachi music. Was called the People's Inauguration Party, and its organizers, the Orange County Employees Association, had hoped Brown would address a crowd of several thousand. Instead, he and his wife grabbed a quick hot dog, chatted with a few dozen people, and then abruptly left. More than a few of the assembled union members felt dissed.
They put a speaker up here, and everybody says he's going to be here, and then he doesn't even show up. I mean, he shows up and shakes a few hands, has a hot dog. Crap.
High school teacher Steve Trombetta said he had waited 2 hours to hear Brown speak.
Speak to the people. He doesn't have to kowtow to the unions, but he has to at least come out and say something,
One can only speculate whether Jerry Brown intended to send a message that he isn't beholden to unions that spent millions on his reelection campaign. But even if Brown is trying to stand tough with a public employees union, it's clear that he'll need them to go along with his budget-slashing program, particularly in the area of pensions, which costs the state about $5 billion a year.
He's not a newcomer to this issue.
Ed Mendel writes an influential blog on California's public pension crisis. He says when Brown was last governor in the early 1980s, he proposed scaling back pensions for new state employees.
When he was running for governor this time, he had an 8-point pension plan, and two of the points were higher contributions from employees and lower pensions for new hires.
Now he has to sell those ideas to a handful of public employee unions. The ever-unpredictable Brown recently appointed two attorneys with long records of representing unions to negotiate on his behalf.
To me, it's like stealing two pitchers from the other team right before the World Series.
Democratic campaign strategist Steve Maviglio.
These two guys have lived and breathed labor relations their whole lives. They're trusted by labor. And, as you send somebody you trust to deliver the news, and there's going to be a lot of bad news delivered.
The biggest union without a contract is the prison guards, who clashed with Brown's predecessor, former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. Ryan Sherman is a spokesman for the guards union.
I'm sure the bad news that he's going to be delivering is there's not going to be a pay raise. Everybody in the state understands that, the tough fiscal times, and it would make sense if you've got a guy that's fair sitting across the table from you that understands where you're coming from. It makes it a lot easier to negotiate even during tough fiscal times.
During the election campaign, Brown's critics predicted he'd give away the store to the unions. But in California, there's no money to give away. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, San Francisco.